How many of you are familiar with the statement? I think it came from Zig Ziglar. If it's to be, it's up to me. Heard that statement? No one? I thought everybody would have heard that statement. If it's to be, it's up to me. Basically, there's some things in life you can't delegate. You just need to go after it. And if you don't go after it, it's not going to happen. But if you make it happen, you can grab it and you can make it happen. And in some ways, it kind of ties into the American dream. You can become whatever you want. Just set your sights on your target and go after it. And in some ways, and when it comes to certain aspects of life, that's good. There are things we should go after. But what if I told you when it comes to the most important thing in your life, that can actually make things worse? When it comes to God's covenant blessings, if it's to be, it's up to me, can make things worse. Now, we're actually in the middle of a crazy story in our Genesis series. If you're here for the first time or you're just checking in through Facebook, we've been going through the book of Genesis, and we left off last week in the middle of this story of family conflict in Isaac's family. And so, you know, we got Jacob and Esau, these rival twins, and we saw that Jacob had swindled his brother out of his birthright. And then last week, Jacob and Rebekah are going to crazy lengths to steal the blessing from Esau. And so Jacob is deceiving. He's actually putting on disguises and wearing goat skins and pretending to be his brother and fooling his dad, whose eyesight is failing. And so they come in and they actually manage to steal the blessing from Esau. And now Esau has this murderous vendetta against Jacob, and we left off right there with Esau wanting to murder Jacob. And we're in the middle of this crazy story where Jacob and his mom Rebekah are saying, let's go after this blessing. If it's to be, it's up to me. And it kind of seems like maybe it's working out that way, and it prompts the question, is that true? So the question we're going to look at this morning is, how does the blessing come? How does God's blessing come? Now, just a quick caveat here. We're talking this morning about God's covenant blessings. We're not just talking about general blessings in life. I mean, in one sense, it's a blessing to be able to say, I graduated. And that's something you should go after. If it's to be, it is up to you. There's general blessings like I dropped 30 pounds or I earned a promotion at work. Now, those are things that you need to go after. You can't just like, I'm going to do nothing and hope it works. No, general blessings, sometimes we need to go after them. That's not what I'm talking about this morning. I'm talking about God's covenant blessings. So let me just catch you up real quick where we've come in Genesis. When I talk about God's blessings, I'm talking about something that's big and overarching and spiritual. It started at the very beginning in the Garden of Eden when the serpent came and caused Adam and Eve to sin. And then Christ comes and says, okay, there's going to be conflict between the woman's offspring, which are the people of God, and the serpent's offspring, which is anyone who does not belong to God by default belongs to the serpent. But God gives this promise, and this is the first hint of blessing. God's people are going to, in the end, crush the serpent. And so when we talk about being a part of God's covenant blessing, we're talking about those who do the crushing as opposed to those who ultimately receive the crushing. And so then it moves on, and we see God appearing to Abraham and to Isaac, and we're going to see today, to Jacob, saying, I will be with you. We're talking about that kind of blessing. Not just in a general sense, God is everywhere, but in a special sense, he is with his people. And in Scripture, when it references God being with its people, it's normally referring to God is present to bless. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this being a part of the woman's offspring that will ultimately crush the serpent. I'm talking about being a part of God's covenant family that enjoys his presence in a special way where he says to you, I will be your God. Now, yeah, he's everyone's God in a sense, but a lot of people reject him. They don't have that family relationship. They're not adopted in. There is a blessing where God can be our God. And he says to Abraham, all the nations will be blessed in you. And there's a special blessing that comes by being joined to God. There's a special protection that's different. There's a special provision that's different. There is a future for all eternity that's different. I'm talking about that blessing. I'm not talking about, oh, I make six figures, I'm so blessed. That may or may not be a part of God's path for your life, and he can bless in that way. But that's not the blessing I'm talking about this morning. I'm talking about covenant blessings. And so we're asking the question, how does this blessing come? And I've only got 2 points this morning. It's a very simple message. 2 points, I'm just going to give them to you one at a time. And so the first one that we're going to look at is blessing does not come from human effort. I want to show you that as we continue the story. Blessing does not come from human effort. And you say, well, Barry, what human effort? And the first thing that we're going to see is the blessing doesn't come through human manipulation. Through human manipulation. And we see this picking up the story actually at the very end of Genesis chapter 27, verse 41. I'm going to overlap a little bit with some verses I read last week. So Jacob has just stolen the blessing from his brother Esau by deceiving his father Isaac. In verse 41, we read, now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are approaching. In other words, Isaac's going to die pretty soon. And once my dad's dead, he says, then I will kill my brother Jacob. Now it turns out Isaac doesn't die for a long time. I don't know if he has a resurgence in health or if he's just on deathbed for decades, but they don't know that at the time. They seem to think Isaac thought he was dying. That's why he called in his son to bless him. And so Esau's like, okay, I'm just going to bide my time just a little bit. Jacob's days are numbered. Verse 42, but the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son. Remember, Rebekah loves Jacob, Isaac loves Esau, and so Rebekah's doing everything she can to cause things to work out for her son Jacob. And she says to him, behold, your brother Esau is comforting himself about you by planning to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice. Arise, flee to Laban, my brother, in Haran, and stay with him a while until your brother's fury turns away. Verse 46, then Rebekah said to Isaac, her husband, I loathe my life because of the Hittite women. Esau had married two Hittite women. If Jacob marries one of the Hittite women like these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me? Then Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and directed him, you must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. Arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take as your wife from there one of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you. We're just going to push pause on the story. What we are seeing here from Rebekah and Jacob, it's more human manipulation. Rebekah is trying to figure out, okay, we got to get Jacob out of here. How can we make Isaac think this is his idea? And so she's going to plant a kind of a seed thought, the idea before the idea that will lead him into the correct solution in such a way that he thinks it's his idea. In the movie Inception, which if you haven't seen this movie, it is a phenomenal movie. It's one of my favorites. Leonardo DiCaprio, he uses this kind of sci-fi military technology to infiltrate people's dreams in order to plant information in their minds. And in the movie, his task is to influence this businessman named Fisher so that Fisher will dissolve the corporate empire he inherited from his father. Now, Fisher would never make such a drastic move on his own. That'd be crazy. The idea would actually need to be planted in him. But he's a pretty ruthless character. You know, if he knew someone was manipulating his mind, all hell would break loose. That'd be a very dangerous situation. And so DiCaprio needs to plant this idea into Fisher's subconscious without Fisher knowing. He actually needs Fisher not only to think that this is a good idea, but he needs Fisher to think that this is his own idea. And so DiCaprio has to be very subtle. If he's too direct, the idea is going to be too jarring, and Fisher's going to know someone's manipulating him, someone's been in his mind. And so DiCaprio takes this very indirect approach. He infiltrates Fisher's dreams, and he plants something that doesn't seem to be directly related to the business. He plants this projection of Fisher's father, dying father, telling him to be his own man. And Fisher wakes up and he starts processing this new emotion, and he becomes determined, I'm not going to live my life by my father's playbook. I want to make my own business decisions. I'm not going to do the things the way my dad did things. I want to make my own decision. I will dissolve the company. He makes his own decision to dissolve the company. And this is kind of like what's going on with Rebecca here. She's thinking, I need Isaac to make his own decision to send Jacob away, but she knows, like, we just deceived him, and, you know, kind of, we're persona non grata right now in our family, so how can I do this diplomatically so Isaac feels like he's leading and not being manipulated? It's like that scene in Big Fat Greek Wedding, I don't know if you've seen this, where Tula's, she's all frustrated, she's like, Mom, Dad's so stubborn, the man is the head of the house, and the mom speaks up, and she's like, let me tell you something, Tula. The man is the head, but the woman is the neck. And she can turn the head any way she wants. And so that's Rebecca here. She is turning the head. And how is she going to do that? Well, she plants this idea that's going to cause Isaac to make this counterintuitive decision to send Jacob away. She knows Esau's wives, his poor choice in wives, have made family life miserable. And so she comes to Isaac saying, Isaac, imagine how much worse things could get if Jacob makes the same mistake. Well, once this thought has been planted, Isaac has this light bulb moment. Aha, I've thought of a solution. Rebecca, you came from Haran. Let's send Jacob there to find a wife. And Rebecca's like, oh, what a brilliant solution, my dear, that you came up with all on your own. Why didn't I think of that? And her manipulative diplomatic success is now complete. Viewed through one lens, Rebecca and Jacob are achieving what they're after. I mean, they stole the blessing. Now Jacob's being sent away just according to their manipulative plan. But in reality, this lifestyle of if it's to be, it's up to me, has only made things worse. I can only imagine Jacob on his way to Haran talking to some guys at the local watering hole and throwing a few back, and he's bragging like, yeah, I stole my brother's blessing. And one of the local herdsmen says, well, how's that working out for you? Well, I'm on the run because my life's in danger from the family that I was blessed to lead. I'm leaving the land that I was blessed to inherit. I've got nothing. I'm actually never going to see my mom again. A friend would be like, congrats. Actually, if it wasn't for the divine intervention that's coming momentarily in the story, Jacob likely would never have been seen or heard from again. The reality is Jacob was blessed in spite of his actions, not because of his actions. The manipulation is only making things worse in this story. Blessing does not come through human manipulation. Sure, you might be able to get some general life blessings by swindling someone out of some money, and now you got a little bit more money, and if that's your definition of the blessed life, okay. But when it comes to the big things that matter, God's covenant blessings, they do not come through human manipulation. What Rebecca and Jacob should have been doing is just trusting that God would keep his promise to bless. Before Jacob was even born, God said, here's the plan. There's twins in your womb. The older is going to serve the younger. And yet Rebecca and Jacob, instead of trusting, like, okay, that's what God said, and I'm going to rest in that, they are using sinful methods to try to go after this blessing, to try to go after this birthright, and it creates chaos. Now, eventually, this is chapters down the road, and we're not going to be there for a while. Eventually, Jacob learns a thing or two about trust. He learns a thing or two about surrender, but he hasn't got there yet, and we're seeing the consequences that come when we look to manipulation instead of rest. And so, people of God, I just want you to know, you don't have to manipulate God. You don't have to manipulate yourself into his favor. You don't have to perform your way into blessing. Like, God really, he offers us rest. He says, trust me, I've promised this. You can take a breath. You can relax. The pressure of all your hopes and dreams and fears, it's not on you, Rebecca. It's not on you, Jacob. And I would say it's not on you, Carol. It's not on you, Ian. It's not on you, Mike. It's not on you, Anna. There's a rest that we are invited into. That's why Jesus says later, he says it real clear. Now, Jesus isn't on the scene yet when this story happens, but Jesus kind of gives it his own language. When he says, like, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. It's a wearisome thing to be trying to manipulate in order to get this sort of blessing. It's a wearisome thing to try to perform your way into God's favor. It's exhausting. And Jesus says, I can take that burden off of you. I can take away from you the burden of, am I okay with God? Is God watching out for me? Am I a part of his promise? Does he have a future for me? Will he protect me? Is he really working all things together for my good? Jesus is like, come to me. I'll give you rest. Trust, you don't have to own that stuff. God's after our faith, not our performance. And that's actually what we see next. So we're seeing blessing doesn't come from human effort. It doesn't come from the effort of human manipulation. And now as we look at Esau briefly, we're going to see it doesn't come from the effort of human performance. So Esau's lost the blessing, but he's still seeking a way to be blessed. I mean, even godless people desire blessing. And he's kind of a tragic figure in that he wants the blessing, but he's spiritually dull. And so the whole time he's on the outside looking in. He never has spiritual sight. And he's a picture, actually, of what happens to serpent offspring. A desire to belong. A desire to be a part. A desire to enter into this kind of rest. A desire to have true security. A desire to have true love. A desire to have true acceptance. And always trying things, but never getting there. Never truly having the true security. Never having the true belonging. Yeah, I might be able to find temporary, you know, connections and blessings along the way, but the true deep ache in the heart never get fulfilled, and Esau never gets there. So here we see he's still seeking blessing, and he notes this connection between his father's blessing, which is God's blessing, and a marriage partner. And so he's like, ooh, okay. Maybe I can perform my way back into some sort of blessing. Look at verse 6. Now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take a wife from there. And that as he blessed him, he directed him, you must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. Those are the local women, which in the context would influence God's people away from God. And so Jacob's being sent to a woman far away, but someone who would come in and partner with God's covenant family instead of being at odds with God's covenant family. So Jacob was directed, you must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. He notes that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and God had gone to Paddan Aram. So when Esau saw that the Canaanite women did not please Isaac, his father, Esau went to Ishmael, his uncle, and took as his wife, beside the wives he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son. Now, the point of this passage isn't to endorse polygamy or even to comment on polygamy. That was just the norm in many cultures in the ancient world, still the norm in many cultures today. The Bible casts a higher vision than that. And so polygamy is actually kind of incidental to the story, so don't get hung up on that. The Bible's not trying to answer questions about polygamy right now. It's trying to tell us something about Esau and performance. And so here's Esau still desiring blessing, and he's trying to gain some approval through his marriage performance. And so he comes to this false conclusion. He's like, oh, my mistake was that I didn't marry in the family. So I'm going to take a wife from Uncle Ishmael's clan. Maybe that will please my father and lead to blessing. But he's actually totally missing the point, because the point here was not marry in the family. The point was that God's covenant family needed to be set apart from the pagan world. And so the reason that Jacob went to Haran to find a wife, because he was trying to find a wife who would participate in the covenant rather than be at odds with it. And Esau failed to grasp this. So he had failed early on in marrying these Hittite wives, because in doing that, he was actually bringing the pagan world into the covenant family. And now he's doing the same exact thing by taking a wife from Ishmael's clan. If you recall, God himself had sent Ishmael away to protect the covenant family. And so now Esau, once again, he's joining that which God had separated. And so he's actually, once again, showing he doesn't understand the covenant. He's showing contempt for the covenant, just as he has done multiple times in his life so far. And so we're seeing his performance falls short. He thinks he's performing well, but even when he's trying to perform well, his performance itself is actually a sin. It doesn't lead to blessing. And so what we see here is, if it's to be, it's up to me. Once again, it's just making things worse. Now he's got three pagan wives in the family. There's really no proverbs out there that says, the more pagan wives you take, the better things will get for you. I've never heard that one. Blessing does not come through human effort. Doesn't come through human manipulation, doesn't come through human performance. And so how does blessing come? And that brings us to the second point, which also is the title of the message. The title of today's message is Blessed by Grace. And the second point is that blessing comes through God's grace. And that's what we're going to see as the story continues. The story actually shows us some remarkable elements of God's grace. And I got to imagine for Jacob, I mean, so if some of this is familiar to us, and you get used to something, and it maybe doesn't seem quite as remarkable anymore, but this is all new. When this story is happening, people are still learning who God is, and God has chosen to reveal himself progressively throughout the ages, and so this is still very early on in human history. And so we see some really remarkable elements of God's grace, and for example, grace is undeserved. Now, I take this just from the context of the story, because Jacob's about to run smack dab into the grace of God, but when you really think about it, you're like, what, Jacob? Jacob's the one who gets God's grace? Jacob's actually rapidly becoming my least favorite Bible character. I'm serious. Like, if someone asked me, who's your least favorite Bible character, it may be Jacob. And actually, over the coming chapters, there's more despicable things that we haven't even seen yet. But we've already seen enough. Cheating Esau out of the birthright revealed that here's an exploitive shyster who takes advantage of hurting people in their pain. Cheating Esau out of the blessing reveals him to be this manipulative conniver who's so ambitious that he will use lies against his father. He will use disguises against his father. He'll actually blaspheme, like the Lord. He gives spiritual sounding answers to his father as part of this deceit, but it's totally false. This is a guy who is seeking to get ahead at any cost. And now he's this fugitive because his treachery has put his life in jeopardy from his own family. He's on the run. He's away from the brother he wanted to rule. He's fleeing the promised land he wanted to inherit. He's seeking refuge from Uncle Laban 400 miles away. Now, in the days of Southwest Airlines, that might not seem like that far, but it probably took him about a month to get there. So that's like, okay, Esau probably won't go on a 30-day journey carrying his tent on his back and trying to find water with no roadmap. That's probably about how far I would need to go to be safe. And so you look at all this, it's like, what a mess. The circumstances are a mess. Jacob himself is a mess. If there was ever someone who didn't deserve anything from God, it was Jacob. One theologian writes, Jacob has messed up his life with his ambition, callousness, deceit, lying, and using the Lord's name to cover his deceit. Jacob deserves God's curse. But instead, God comes to him with wonderful promises. And there are no conditions. It's pure grace. And I just find it remarkable that it's this guy who has the first dream encounter in Scripture with the living God. He seems to me almost like a Paul of the Old Testament. When Paul says, you know, I was the worst of sinners. To me, who is the worst of sinners, God appeared so that his mercy might be put on display. And I think something similar is happening here with Jacob. Like, man, this is a despicable guy, and yet God chose him to be, his name gets changed to Israel. He's the father of the 12 tribes. Like, this is the guy. I just find that remarkable. And that's why I say grace is undeserved. It's undeserved. And maybe you're here this morning, and you don't deserve to be anyone's favorite character. Maybe you've fallen off the pedestal, just like Jacob. I don't know, maybe you've fallen off the pedestal with your spouse. Maybe it's your own fault. Maybe you created a mess. Maybe you've fallen off the pedestal with your kids. I don't know what's going on in your family. Maybe you've fallen off the pedestal at work with your boss. Maybe it's with your friends. I don't know, maybe you've created your own mess, but here's what I do know. There's not that many messes that rise to the level of Jacob's. And yet, that's the sort of person that God gives grace to. So I want to encourage you this morning not to disqualify yourself from grace, because you actually can't qualify yourself through any of your effort anyways. That's not how grace works. Grace is for the undeserving. And even if you're on pretty high on some pedestals in people's lives, I want to also just point out that in an ultimate sense, we are all Jacob in that we have all sinned against our Father. We've all failed against our Father. We've all broken that relationship. We all deserve to be exiled. There's this separation. There's this gap between us and our Father. We all, you know, deserve to be kind of persona non grata, like Jacob and Rebecca were. That's all of us. Like, so we can think that Jacob is our kind of despicable character, our least favorite character, but let's be careful that we don't cast ourselves into the hero role of, oh, I'd be so much greater. Actually, we kind of are all Jacob. But the good news is there's grace for Jacobs. It doesn't come through our performance. As we continue on in the story, we're going to see that grace is initiated by God. So the blessing comes through God's grace. God's grace doesn't come through human effort. It's something that's undeserved. And as we're going to see in verse 10, grace is initiated by God. So here, Jacob is leaving. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. I've seen your deceit and your treachery, and you are toast. Oops, no, that's the BSV translation, Barry Smith version. Let's read from the ESV. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south, and in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. But here's Jacob. He's running from his mess, and he runs smack dab into undeserved favor that he didn't initiate. He's fleeing, not seeking God. If anything, he's seeking a wife. And yet he has this dream encounter with God, and it's filled with all this language showing us that grace is initiated by God. We see it in this phrase that he dreamed this ladder set up on earth. The original Hebrew that this was written in more literally reads, it was a ladder that was placed toward the earth. And we don't know if it was an actual ladder. It's kind of a vague term, or it might have been a staircase or some kind of a ziggurat with stair steps up to heaven. And I think we're supposed to understand this in contrast to the Tower of Babel. Because earlier in Genesis, not too many chapters back, the Tower of Babel was man's initiative through his own effort to ascend toward heaven. And it didn't work. It failed spectacularly. And here we're seeing, no, it's heaven that takes the initiative to descend down towards earth. It's actually God taking it on himself to bridge the gap between human and divine. We see more language indicating that grace is initiated by God. Like God says, I will give to you. He doesn't say, okay, you've earned this. Here's your wage. No, he says, I will give. It's showing that this blessing, it's a gift from above. It's not the result of human manipulation. It's not the result of human performance. And then God says this, more language of divine initiative. He says, all families or all peoples of earth are going to be blessed in you. Now, this is remarkable language. Most of these families don't even know that God exists. They're certainly not doing something or taking some sort of initiative that would bring divine blessing. And yet God has plans for them. God has plans to bless the whole earth. It's because he's a God who takes initiative. Grace is initiated by God. God goes along on to say, he says, I will keep you. In the midst of, you know, Jacob, he's manipulated and he's flying away because he's trying to protect himself, God actually comes in and initiates the very safety that Jacob is trying to bring about on his own. And then he finishes with this flourish of eyes. God's like, I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. It's I will, I'll do, I'll keep, I'll bless. This is language of divine initiative. Grace is initiated by God. And you say, why is all this happening? And it's because God has a plan to bless all families. So God tells Jacob, I'm going to bless you. And in my blessing you, it's going to lead to a blessing for all peoples of the earth. And so what this is telling us something. Jacob's not only blessed for his own sake. Yes, God does care about the man, Jacob. And God, our individual blessing matters to God. But Jacob was also blessed so that others could be blessed. In fact, Jacob was blessed so that you could be blessed. God had a plan for Jacob to become the nation of Israel and Christ to come out of Israel. And ultimately, it's in Christ that the blessing spreads from Israel to Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth through Christ's Spirit in us. And we're seeing it. Every year, more and more unreached people groups are captured by the gospel, and more of the globe is becoming Christian in spite of increasing opposition across the earth. The people of God are spreading because God's keeping his promise that all families of the earth will be blessed. And so this means something like, yeah, we're blessed by God, but you're not blessed just for you either. We're blessed in order to be a blessing. We're blessed in order that others could be blessed through us. That's part of why we have a church that seeks to spread the good news of Jesus, so that others are connected into this covenant blessing and that they don't end up serpent offspring. They end up offspring of the woman, part of God's family. Well, it kind of leads to this question, like, man, Jacob, okay. I mean, on the one hand, if you're Jacob, you're really glad that grace is undeserved and that grace is initiated by God. And yet it raises the question, like, okay, so if I'm a Jacob, like, well, how can someone so undeserving be blessed? And an answer comes from the book of John when Jesus actually quotes from this very passage. Look what Jesus says in John chapter 1, verse 51. He's talking to some of his disciples, and he says, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. So Jesus is actually talking. He's using language straight from the story. No doubt he's drawing on the story. And yet he's saying the ladder that the angels of God ascend and descend on are the Son of Man, himself. In other words, he's saying, I'm the ladder. I'm the one that bridges the gap between God and man. I'm the mediator between God and man. That's why he says later on, he's like, I am the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. You wonder how the gap could be bridged between God's favor and rascals like Jacob? It's because Jesus came. And Jesus says, okay, I'm going to be the mediator. I'm going to go to the cross. So he went to the cross for Jacob's treachery. He wore the sin of Jacob's deceit on the cross. He wore the sin of Jacob's swindling and exploiting on the cross. He wore the sin of Rebekah's manipulating on the cross. It wasn't just Jacob's sin he wore to the cross. He wore the sin of the Jacob and all of us to the cross. Everything that's caused us to fall off of anyone's pedestal, any mess that we've created in our life, Jesus is like, I'll wear that to the cross. There is going to be a consequence for that. Never think that sin doesn't have consequence. It did have consequence, but Jesus says, I'll take the consequence onto myself. And in doing so, he makes it possible for our slate to be wiped completely clean, for forgiveness to be given to us. And God's not just a judge who, okay, makes sure that sin is punished and moves on. No, he's the sort of judge who he pardons the criminal, and then he adopts the criminal into his family, but he doesn't leave us with criminal hearts. What would that do if God just had this family for all eternity full of criminals? We're just a bunch of Jacobs swindling and cheating and trying to get ahead. What kind of a forever family would that be? No, God doesn't do that because grace transforms us. So we no longer have a criminal heart, and that's what we're going to begin to see in the rest of this Jacob story is this transformation that's brought about by grace. So we've seen that grace is undeserved. We've seen that grace is initiated by God. And the last thing we're going to see this morning is that grace awakens response. It brings about a transformation in our lifestyle. So look with me at verse 16. This is Jacob responding to the dream he just had. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God and this is the gate of heaven. So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on the top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel. But the name of the city was Luz at the first. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. So we shouldn't look at this story and just assume, well, yeah, I guess actions don't really matter to God. We can just be despicable Jacobs. No, actually what we're seeing here is actions do matter to God. And it's encountering grace that has the greatest transformative effect on our actions. That's what's happening here with Jacob. He's encountering God, running into the grace of God, and his life is changed as a result. One of our core values actually kind of ties into this. One of our core values is proclamation and encounter. That truth is not only a proposition to be declared, it's also a person to be encountered. And so Jacob had heard about God. He'd heard the proclamation. He knew about Abraham. He knew about his father, Isaac. But now he has encountered God. And there's something about both coming together, the truth and the experience, and encountering God's presence completely reorients Jacob's life. And so this grace begins to awaken a response in Jacob. And you say, what response? And these verses are just dripping with a person being transformed. We see first that he has a godly fear. Says that Jacob was afraid. So here he is. He's just stolen from Isaac, who's blessed by God, deceived Isaac, blasphemed God, and now he meets God. Dope. And he recognizes, when you meet God, all of a sudden you realize, oh, this God is holy. And the things that seemed okay in your life before, all of a sudden, you know, they're not okay. They're not okay. Proverbs 9:10 tells us, actually, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so this is the beginning of a change in Jacob's life. His trajectory has changed because now he has an appropriate understanding of who God is, an appropriate awe, and the contrast between him and God awakens a healthy fear. So we see a godly fear. We see worship. I'm not going to go into all the symbolism here, but that's what's going on. He's consecrating the stone that was his pillow, and he's pouring oil on it, and he's renaming it Bethel, which means house of God. Basically, he's making this place a temple. This is a place of worship. This is a place set aside to pay homage to the true God. So he's got godly fear. He's beginning to worship, and then we see the beginnings of a yielded life in this vow. Now, some people read this vow and they're like, oh, see, Jacob is still bargaining because he's going to become a bargainer. And he's still got a ways to go in his character development. You don't change overnight. Your trajectory can change overnight. Your values can change overnight. But character takes a while. And so this is not Jacob saying, okay, if God, if you'll do this and if you'll do that and if you'll do this, then okay. No, this is Jacob realizing, wow. If God is like this, and God's going to bring me, and God's promising this to me, then I'm yielding. I'm yielding my life. One theologian writes, vows are not contracts or limited agreements, but yieldings that reorient life. And so this vow here actually represents a transformation that's taking place in Jacob's life. And we see him changing from a grasper to a giver. It's like, okay, God, right now I have nothing. I can't give you anything. But if you give me stuff, like you say, I'm giving it back to you. I recognize it comes from you. My life belongs to you. I'm going to be a steward. And so here's a man who's responding to grace. Here's a man who's being transformed. So never think that grace means actions don't matter. No, it's grace that really enables us and frees our hearts so that we can become a different person. It's grace that transforms. The story is filled with transformations. Bruce Waltke writes, the story is filled with transformations due to God's presence. A man running away from home runs into God. A man afraid of his brother fears God. A certain place becomes nothing less than God's place. A rock becomes a temple. Night turns to morning. Canaanite Luz becomes Bethel, the house of God. That's what grace does. Grace awakens response. And so now we see the very first admirable things about Jacob in this story. I guess I would ask you, what came first? His godly actions or grace? It's grace that came first. Grace awakens response. And when actions are flowing from grace, they're not striving, performing actions, trying to earn something from God. That doesn't work. You don't get blessing that way. But when grace comes first and actions flow from it, it's a lifestyle of gratitude. It's a lifestyle of worship. And that's what God's after. I'm not trying to earn something from him. We don't deserve anything from him. We are despicable Jacobs. We had swindled and deceived. We're separated from our Father. But he comes. He meets us in grace. And if we'll surrender to the grace, he begins a transforming work in our hearts. And that's how blessing comes about. It's when we say, okay, I'm going to trust God, not my effort. I'm going to rest in what God has done. I'm not going to manipulate things. I'm going to put my faith in God. I'm going to trust his promise. I'm not going to strive to try to accomplish this on my own. And so ultimately, the answer of our question, how does blessing come? It's because God says, if it's to be, it's up to me. And God's the one who takes it on himself because he knows we're going to mess it up. It's like when I was a youth pastor and we were supposed to clean up after ourselves. And the very first time I experienced this, I just thought, okay, you do the sweeping, you do the vacuuming. And I appointed some kids to wipe down the counter. And then they cleaned and went home. And then I came in to see their cleaning. I'm like, oh my goodness, they have no clue how to clean up their own mess. And that's when I learned, okay, after a youth group event, if the mess is going to be cleaned up, it's up to me. And in a sense, the book of Genesis is showing us man never could clean up his own mess. Over and over, we showed, if it's up to us, the blessing's not going to happen. And so God steps in like a good youth pastor, and he says, okay, if it's going to be, it's up to me. And he takes it onto himself. He's taken your blessing onto himself. And if you belong to God, it's because God came to you, and maybe it wasn't as dramatic as an encounter as Jacob had, but he came to you in grace and made himself known to you in such a way that your heart responded to him. And so you can rest in that. He's come to you. He's found you. His covenant blessings are for you, so that means he will be with you. It means the serpent offspring is not ultimately going to triumph over you. It means there is a day coming when you're going to enter into the land of promised rest. There's an eternal future there for you where God dwells with you and he is your God and we're in his family. You're blessed. You're blessed. And the blessing comes because of God's grace. You are blessed by grace. Amen.